Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. On the podcast today, I'm joined by Dr. Jean-François Doust, a lecturer in the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Edinburgh. Dr. Doust is co-author with Dr. André Blay of a book titled The Motivation to Vote, which was published in 2020 by UBC Press. Although we spend a lot of time talking about which party or candidate is up or down in the polls, or which issues voters care most about, elections are fundamentally about the act of voting. Why do people vote? Why do others stay home? And what role do perceptions, attitudes, and values play into voter turnout? In their book, Blay and Doust write, "Voting is a quintessential human decision based on a combination of emotions and instrumental calculations, full of complexities, ambiguities, and sometimes contradictions." Lots for us to unpack. In our conversation, we explore voting, talk about his book, and go deep exploring why some people vote and others don't. If you haven't read the book, I strongly recommend it. This conversation was fascinating. I hope you think so too. From now on, fellow citizens, all right, follow me and vote for Mr. Rhythm Jamboree. Well, thank you, Dr. Doust, for joining the podcast and sharing some time with us. In your introduction, you write, "The probability that a single vote will decide the outcome of an election is close to nil. And so whether or not one votes will not decide which party will ultimately win." So, and I think most people would say that's true, except for those rare exceptions where an election is incredibly close. Given that, then, you know, why do people vote at all?
Well, this is very important because it directly responds to one of the most influential school of thought when it comes to explain what makes people vote. And this school of thought is the rational choice theory that was notably popularized by Anthony Downs with an economic theory of democracy. So that's a very influential idea, that people vote to decide the outcome of an election. And well, fortunately, that's a very straightforward test idea to test. And it has been done by André Blay, the co-author of the book, in 2000 in his book, To Vote or Not to Vote. And clearly the main conclusion, the main take of the book is that this is clearly not the main factor that drives citizens' decision to vote or abstain. So it is something else. It's not about whether you will your vote will be pivotal, so we'll decide the outcome of an election. And in our book, basically, we argue that it's about a mixture of deeply rooted predispositions, and we will have two of these factors, and also a mixture of attitudes that are a bit more proximate to election, so a bit more contextual. So basically, it's not about the idea that you can decide the outcome of an election. It's rather a mixture of two predispositions and two attitudes that are more contextual to elections.
So let's dig a little deeper into those four factors. First, maybe share quickly with listeners, how did you, test your hypotheses and come to those conclusions?
Yes. Well, first of all, we make use of the Making Electoral Democracy Work data set, where we benefit from data from five countries. So France, Canada, Germany, Spain, and Switzerland. So 27 elections, both national and regional elections. 27 elections, five countries, thousands of respondents with survey data. So that's basically our the data that we rely on. And we developed several hypotheses based on the predispositions that we focus on and the attitudes that we focus on. And more specifically, we contend that people who are more interested in politics will be more likely to vote. So here the key is political interest. We think that people who think that voting is a civic duty, they will be more likely to vote, so civic duty. And then two more proximate attitudes will come out and play. But first, on these predispositions, mm-hmm. So we take political interest as we conceive it as a taste for politics, so a personal taste. It's fundamentally individual. The same way that some people follow the NHL hockey games, and some people are interested in following what's happening with the monarchy. And some people have very different tastes in life. Well, some people are really interested in politics, not because they conceive it as a duty to be informed about politics. It's just because they are interested in it. And I think that many of your students and probably yourself will relate to this. Some people are, we call them political junkies. Yeah. It's a taste for politics. And that's really what we want to measure. It's not about the interest toward a specific election. So let's say the 2020 US election. No, it's about a general taste for politics.
And is that just on that point? Is it black or white, or is there a scale in your mind that you can be kind of like me, probably on one end, who reads polling numbers and follows, you know, power and politics on TV, like baseball fanatics look at box scores, you know, in the newspaper, versus somebody who like literally has no interest in it. There must be some scale there, right?
Yeah. Of course, it's a continuum. To use your analogy, let's say that we talk about baseball. Well, some people really enjoy baseball, and not only they will go to the stadium and look at the baseball game, but they will also watch the ones that they can attend, and then they will go on the internet and look at the number, the means for that. What happens when you face a left pitcher versus a right pitcher? The same way that you would not be satisfied by looking at voter turnout at the national level. You will go on the internet and break down by provinces, by counties, by cities, and stuff like that. Right. So it's really a continuum. And on the other end, some people will watch some games when it's there on TV. They will tune in because, well, the context is that they will enjoy to tune in. And some people will really dislike baseball. They will even find it fun to say that they do not like it. They prefer other things. They prefer basketball or stuff like that. So it's a continuum, and that's what we aim to measure with a quite straightforward question, a 0 to 10 scale. Of course, some people there will be a social desirability bias to say that we are somewhat interested in politics. But there is still a really interesting amount of variance. Some people really do say that they are interested at 2 or 3 out of 10, while some people say 9 or 10 out of 10 on that scale. And that's really the most important predisposition that we focus on.
And it's just really interesting. You mentioned the group who would say, "I hate politics," and that comes to define them. It becomes an identity point, right? Like, and therefore I will not vote because all politicians are crooks, right? Like that sort of, you actually could see how this variable becomes really powerful in actually, not just because people aren't engaged or interested in politics, but it actually becomes something that they say, I have absolutely no interest in, and I choose not to vote because of that. It's really interesting.
Yes, and that's a direct effect on the decision to vote, but it will also influence some other attitudes, like we sometimes call it political efficacy, but the idea that, well, basically I have nothing, no impact at all in politics, also the distrust toward politicians and stuff like that. So political interest is really, it's causally prior to many of these attitudes and opinion. So it's really powerful because there's a direct effect, but also an indirect effect on these things. So yeah, political interest is our main factor. And when we look at the probability to vote, when someone is at zero and then gradually becomes more interested in politics, we see a huge effect here. So in terms of probability to vote, if we compare someone who's at zero, compare that individual to someone who's at 10, well, there's a difference of 50 percentage point. Mm-hmm. So basically, we move from a 30 percentage point probability to 80%. And that's huge. In social sciences, we rarely see such an effect. Of course, it's rare that someone will move from 0 to 10, but still, just taking a 2 or 3 point increase is still very important here.
So before we get on to duty, just a little bit about that variable then, because I think in your book you talk about other research that shows, you know, as you said, interest in politics. It's rare to find somebody who goes, let alone 10 points on that scale, but even 5 or 6 over the course of a few years. So is interest in politics relatively stable? Or, you know, are there instances where you could see actually somebody or groups of people becoming more engaged in politics because of the context of politics in their country or in the world?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because if that variable is so powerful, then it's important to understand how it moves and in which direction and when it can move, if it can move at all. And that was not our purpose in this book, but there's a huge, literally huge, much lengthier book by Marcus Pryor from Princeton. It's called Hooked. And basically the argument, it's only about political interest, that book. And the argument is that you develop, or you don't, or you do not develop a taste for politics quite early in your life, when you are a teenager. And basically, it also comes from socialization. And then it is very stable over a lifetime. So it's very stable. It's not only relatively stable, but it's very stable. But of course, you can see some movements, but they will be usually modest and contextual. So for example, if you have an important political event that will affect one subgroup, it is possible that you will see an increase for that kind of group. But overall, the main take is that it's very stable and it comes from early in your life.
Okay. So the second sort of deep-seated, I would say it's not even attitudinal. I think it's deeper than that. It's almost a values-based idea. Sorry?
It's a predisposition.
A predisposition is the sense of duty, right? Voting is a part of the civic duty. Can you explain the basis for that and how powerful that is as a variable?
Yeah, so we already know that there is a strong relationship between thinking personally that voting is a civic duty compared to a right choice to vote. So we knew that, but in our book we conceive it really as a sense of moral civic duty, and that's in line with previous André Blais' work. But there is a Kantian here, a Kant moral aspect that really should not be neglected. Whereas I do vote because it's a civic duty, that duty is not related, is totally separated from consideration related to interest. So for example, decide which candidate will win the election and represent my interest, or also social pressure from my friends and stuff like that. So it's really an individual perception that I have a moral duty to vote. And we measure this using a question that is tapping one's guiltiness. So there is that moral aspect here. Guiltiness if I would not vote. So basically, how guilty would you feel if you would not vote in this election? And and the rational here is that the more guilty you would feel if you would not vote, the more dutiful you are, because you would experience guiltiness. And as for political interests, we see a strong relationship here, but that is a little bit less important. So basically, I mentioned that there was a 50 percentage point maximum effect for political interest. And for civic duty, that's a 40 percentage point. But again, that's very important. That's the effect of civic duty that we measure through guiltiness.
Right. So just on that, like, I guess you could debate the different measures to measure the concepts, you know, but if guiltiness, I get the tie to duty. Couldn't you also feel guilty given any, I mean, you looked at a number of elections over different countries in the data set, so you could kind of, you know, controls for some of the context, but like, you know, you hear stories that use the 2020 US election, like, you know, there's many people who probably felt guilty if they didn't vote, but not because they felt it was a civic duty, but because it was such an important election, or they thought it was such an important election, right? Do you think there's any potential conflict, like, that it's effectively measuring the concept?
Well, yeah, there are clearly other ways to measure it. And one of these ways would be to dichotomize whether someone thinks that voting is first and foremost a choice or a duty. Mm. And we had this measure, and it worked quite fine, but the problem was with the translation, especially with Germany, where it was very difficult to capture choice. That word was very difficult to measure, while guiltiness was clearer. And also, it's really close to our theoretical framework, right, of duty, because there is that Kantian moral aspect. So we believe that it is consistent with our theoretical approach, and the empirical result that we find are also very consistent.
Guilt is a universal concept, right? And everyone's got their own language to describe it. As an Italian, I feel it. Catholic, I feel it all the time. That's great. So those are the two dispositions. So your interest in politics, and you said that explains a big chunk, right, of whether somebody's going to vote or not. So if you are not interested in politics and will not feel any guilt if you don't vote, the likelihood you vote is very small.
Very small, less than flipping a coin.
Okay. So then you get on more what I'll call temporal or more contextual, like recent kind of variables, things that affect individual elections, right? And you point to whether somebody will care about the outcome or not, and yes, whether I perceive it to be easy to vote or not. Explain how those two impact.
Yes, exactly. So these two variables are we label them care and easiness, and they are contextual in the way that they vary to a greater extent than political interest and civic duty, but they are not contextual factors in the sense that there would be a lot of variance across elections. That said, there is a certain amount of of variance. For example, in Europe, in Germany, Spain, Switzerland, France, there is a variance when it comes to, for example, European election. People care a bit less about the outcome of the European election compared to regional or national election. So it's in that way that there is a certain, an interesting deal of variance that is less there for political interest and civic duty. And basically, care is very straightforward to measure. We ask people, how much do you care which party is going to form the next government? Okay, and the idea is that the more I care, the more I am likely to vote. And for easiness, we ask people how personally they think that voting is easy or not. It's not a dichotomy here. It's a continuum. I don't recall exactly the question wording, but is it very difficult, somewhat easy, or very easy? And it's about people's perception, because at the end of the day, it's about their perceptions, right? It's about measuring their opinion about this, no matter if it's actually really easy to vote. It's about their perception. And in both cases, we find a positive relationship. So the more I care, the more likely I am to vote. And the more easy, as voting is perceived to be easier, the more likely I am to vote. However, these effects are smaller than the effects from the predispositions. So I mentioned 50 percentage points for political interest, 40 for civic duty. Well, that falls to 30. Which is still very interesting, but it's 30 percentage point for care and 20 percentage point of a maximum effect for the cost of voting. So how easy is it to vote? So overall, it really helps to go beyond the two main predispositions, and altogether they explain a very important part of the variation in individuals' decision to vote or not to vote, And this variance explained is greater than contextual factors like the electoral system. You know, we sometimes talk about mm-hmm. this. We did so a lot in 2015 with Justin Trudeau. And also the level of election. Well, our individual factors are more important than these variables. So yeah, overall, two predispositions, two attitudes, and yeah, we believe that we can make a great deal out of them.
So before we get into the exploring some of the practical applications of the research, then you do spend one chapter in your book addressing, you know, the hypothesis that's also in the literature that voting is habitual, right? That if you start at a young age, you're going to end up doing it. You're more likely to do it. In fact, I was having a debate with a colleague. I was talking about our interview today, and he said, "Oh, it's all about habit," right? Like he brought up the example. And I think, you know, you look at organizations like Student Vote as an example, which its not only goal is to get students in the habit of voting, they say, but is to create interest, right? I think that's how I would frame it now if I was them. I would say our goal is to create interest in politics, not necessarily to create the habit of voting.
Like an investment for the long run.
Right. So on that case of habit, you know, what did your research suggest around that? Like, is there such a thing as habit when it comes to voting? Or is it simply what appears to be the actual outcome of all the other variables you've measured? That it becomes a habit because I'm interested, because I care, because I believe it's a duty, and I believe it's easy to vote. And that's why I just habitually do it, because those things don't really change over time.
Yeah, it's very popular right now. Let's call it the habitual voter model. It's very popular. Many people, especially profs, believe in it, and it's like a fatality. It's like essentialism. It's habit. It's there. It only depends on your past behavior. Well, that's probably the most controversial chapter, and we believe that that's certainly happens for few people, but for some people out there, but it's not, it should not like deserve the current attention that it deserves, at least in terms of explanatory power. And basically we start by looking at what it means, what does it mean? And it's very intriguing because while many people write on the habitual voter model, they rarely define what they mean by habit. What's a habit? We know what it is, but what is it? Well, if we look at the dictionary, there are three criteria, basically. It needs to be a behavior that is repeated, that is regular, and that is automatic. Okay? That's very simple, very straightforward. Okay? And I'll take an example that you... Well, at least probably your students will relate too. But in the morning, when we wake up, we get out of bed, what do we do? Well, most of the time we'll make coffee, right? And before doing any substantial activity, we'll drink our coffee. Well, that behavior is a repeated one. It's every 24 hours or so. It's regular and it's automatic. I do not have an inner debate whether I should have that coffee or not. It's automatic, right? I just do it. I drink it while checking my emails and stuff like that. That's a habit, okay? And we have many habits. There are good habits, bad habits, and that's very clear. Now, let's apply this. So we take time to define habit, contrary to, because we think it's important to be clear about what we're talking about. Let's apply this to the act of voting. Well, is it repeated? Yes. I mean, to a certain degree, it's repeated. Is it regular? It can be regular. It can be every 4 years, but then you have snap elections, three snap elections in a row. Then is it really regular? It's a bit less clear. And is it automatic? Well, I mean... that is not obvious at all, because you have debates, you're not sure whether you're going to vote. It depends on discussions that you will have. It depends on many things beyond the predispositions that we've discussed. So it's not obvious at all for us that it fits the basic criteria from the dictionary. Okay, but then beyond the theoretical discussion that is problematic, we move to an empirical test, because the habitual voter is straightforward. If you acquire a habit, as you mentioned, if you acquire a habit quite early in your life, well, as you age, it's a done deal, right? If you voted previously, you will vote. If you abstain, you will abstain. So the hypothesis is simple. Older people, those who acquired a habit, should not be moved, should not be influenced in their decision to vote or not by more proximate contextual factors compared to younger people who did not acquire a habit and will be moved by these contextual factors. So we did several tests, and we include another data set from the Making Electoral, from the CSES, a comparative study of electoral system, to complement the Making Electoral Democracy data set. And we systematically fail to find evidence for that idea that older people who acquire a habit are less affected by contextual factor. So not only there is a theoretical discussion here that is quite problematic, but at the empirical level, it's not clear at all that there is strong evidence for that theory, despite the fact that it is very popular right now. So, well, that said, it's very important that to note that we do not challenge the correlation between past behavior and current behavior. But the explanation, if we move aside the explanation of habit for the reasons mentioned, well, it's very clear in our model why that correlation is strong. It's because I am interested or not, and that does not change a lot over my lifetime. And the same applies for civic duty, and that care and easiness are also, well, relatively a bit less, but, well, quite less. But basically, what drives the decision to vote or abstain is stable. Right. So it is normal to find such a correlation between past behavior and current behavior.
Interesting. So you're probably explaining the same thing, but it's the concept itself is wrong. It's not habit. It is the factors you have identified that just keep repeating themselves over and over with the same group of people. So it looks like habit, but it's just...
But it's fundamental. But the explanation is fundamentally different, right?
Yes, fundamentally. And that gets to the point I want to talk about is then, if you are Elections Canada or an organization that is seeking to increase voter turnout across the country, what do you think the focus should be based on your research?
So while it is perfectly fine and interesting to devote energy to make it clear that it is easy to vote and that this will affect citizens' proclivity to vote, to turn out and vote, we should devote at least as much energy, and perhaps maybe more, to trying to develop a sense of civic duty and enhance citizens' political interest. And a good example is Australia, where Election Day is very special, you know. For example, the elementary schools, the kids there are involved in designing a temporary coffee shop where you would go out and vote with your neighbor, you would chat with them at this temporary coffee, you would buy a coffee, and the money will be used by kids for their special project. So you can see that everything is connected here that makes it a special day where you socialize with people. And yeah, so that could be a way to enhance civic duty. But that's just one example. But the main take here is that we should focus more energy on these factors rather than devoting a disproportionate proportion of our resources to convince citizens that it's easy to vote. So that's one of the implications that could be useful to organization.
There seems to me an obvious case to test against your model and your findings, and that's the last presidential election in the United States. You had record voter turnout, historic, right? For highest in over 100 years, I think, 67% of eligible voters, which isn't that high comparative to other countries, but still for the U.S., really high.
And so it seems to me that like the four variables that were core to your explanation, I think might explain what happened in the US. Certainly, you know, interest in politics, that might have gone up slightly over the last few years in the US. I don't think civic duty is, nor should it, right? It's a predisposition. But certainly caring about the outcome and even ease of voting seems like the 2020, because of the pandemic and because of Trump, seemed to create a perfect condition by which those explanations help to tell us why turnout went so high. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting case. And as you mentioned, for political interest, it's likely that it probably did not move a lot. Although there is a new generation of voters coming in. So if they are socialized and interested in politics, it might increase a bit. For civic duty, however, I might say that there's this possibility that if things were framed in a more moral case here, that the act of voting would not simply be about participating in the political life, but rather in terms of moral obligation. So if the framing moved a bit, it is possible that people would feel that there is a sense of a civic duty to vote a bit more compared to previous elections, but probably not a high increase here, a huge increase. But you are fully right that for care about the outcome of the election, which is, again, a bit more flexible here, more contextual, at least compared to interest and civic duty. Well, this can partly explain the increase in voter turnout, because people cared more about the electoral outcome. That's pretty straightforward. And I think that, yes, it can account for at least an interesting part of the variation here. And for the easiness to vote, I don't know. It is possible that things like almost universal mail ballots, early voting, and stuff like that were, of course, related to the pandemic, helped citizens. They might have thought that it's easier to vote. But at the same time, there was quite a lot of media coverage of the long waiting lines issues in some counties that could have not encouraged voters to think that it's easy to vote, and rather make them think that they would lose half a day or 8 hours to vote. So I'm actually agnostic about this, but at least for care, that's very straightforward and clear that this can partly account for the increase of voter turnout. Yeah.
Well, Jean-Francois, thank you for spending the time with us. Your book, The Motivation to Vote, Explaining Electoral Participation with Dr. André Blay, is easy to read, short, and to the point. It's elegant in its explanation. And so I encourage everyone who hasn't to pick up a copy. And thanks again for joining us, and look forward to seeing more of your research in the years to come.
Well, thanks a lot for the invitation, and I wish you all a great semester.